Hi, I'm Nick Rigoretti's, and this is the Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood Podcast, the show for grapplers and martial artists that want to evolve both on and off the mat. Hey guys, welcome to episode 33 of the Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood Podcast. Before we start the show, I just want to remind you guys that, as per usual, as my podcast listeners, you guys are entitled to get 10% off any of our awesome jiu-jitsu stuff over at store.jiu-jitsubrotherhood.com. We have pretty much everything a jiu-jitsu player could want, including gis, belts, rash guards, and patches for your gi. We also have really high quality instructional materials that we put a lot of thought and effort into, and that help a lot of people with their jiu-jitsu. And it really does help the show if you guys support us by heading over and picking something up at store.jiu-jitsubrother.com. Just use the code PODCAST and you'll get 10% off anything in the store. And also, if you're wanting to try CBD oil for its benefits for reducing inflammation and pain after training, the more I travel and the more I meet new people on the mats, the more I'm finding that this is something that really does seem to be helping people. So it's definitely something worth giving a try. I tried yesterday a specific external use application CBD oil that you rub into your skin that helps with muscle pain, and it seemed to do a pretty good job. And there's quite a lot of evidence that's backing up CBD and its use for post-sports relaxation. So head on over to Truth Naturals, where they've got amazing CBD products, and use the code JJBTruth and you'll get a discount on that. And also, guys, as I've asked you in the past, it would really mean a lot to me if you'd leave a review for the show on iTunes, because the more good reviews we have, the more people listen, which means the more feedback I get, and the more feedback I get, the more motivated I am to keep doing the show and keep putting out good content for you guys. So I'd appreciate it if you'd head on over and leave a review. So this week's guest is a gentleman named Gerald Garland, who I haven't known very long. I've known him a couple of years. I met him at Undisputed in Arizona, where I teach lessons a couple of times a week. And we instantly hit it off. I liked the guy straight away. Very cool dude. But since I moved here a few months ago, our friendship between he and I has been developing. He's a very cool guy. You know, we moved into a new house 2 months ago, and he was the first person I thought to ask to help me move. And I didn't even know Gerald very well. And he came and spent a day, didn't even think twice, came and spent a day helping me move. And just that really showed me what kind of a person he was. He's got some interesting stories. He's been stationed all over the world in the military, and he's just a genuinely funny, entertaining and engaging human being. He's also got some great jiu-jitsu and I would say an encyclopedic knowledge of the sport. And I just wanted to give you guys all a chance to get to know him as I've had a chance to get to know him. So here's my friend and training partner, Gerald Garland. Enjoy the show. Hey guys, welcome to the Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood show. We are on episode 33. Apparently in spiritual circles, 33 is a very powerful number. The French call it the age of Christ on the cross. It's the same age Jesus was when he was crucified. And apparently it's got mystical powers. I don't know if that's true, but I do know that the guest I have on today definitely has mystical powers. It is a relatively new friend of mine, a gentleman named Gerald Garland, who is a brown belt, and he trains with me at Undisputed here in Tucson. Gerald, I'm so happy to have you on the show, my man.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So good. So, my man, let's start. You're an interesting dude. You've got a lot of cool stories. I'm hoping to get some of them out of you today. Let's start with the way you found jiu-jitsu. I think that's a nice lead-in.
It's kind of a trope. I found jiu-jitsu probably like a bunch of people. UFC 2 was on pay-per-view, and I watched Hoyce Gracie. And even before that, I wrestled in high school and I did all that. So, you know, grappling was, I really enjoyed it. And saw Hoyce Gracie and I thought, I got to learn this stuff. But in 1994, there was no jiu-jitsu of note in Sacramento. So I joined a traditional Korean martial arts school called Taekuk Musul, right?
Say that one more time.
Taekuk Musul.
Damn.
I think it stands for traditional Korean martial art. I don't know.
Okay.
But I was lucky because the instructor that was there at the school I walked into actually did judo at UCLA with the guys there. And so I did a lot of grappling and a lot of gi stuff, no gi stuff. And,
okay.
Really got thrown around a lot. And then I joined the Army in 1997. And one day I was at the gym and I saw these guys on stage, the stage at the gym, doing jujitsu. And I said, man, I gotta learn this. I think I know what I'm doing a little bit because I trained in, you know, Taekwondo Musul, and I'm a green belt or blue belt, something. I was some kind of belt.
As long as you weren't a gold belt.
Exactly, right? And I went up there and I thought I knew what I was doing, and I did a 5-minute round with the guy and got submitted probably about 7 times with a rear naked choke every time. And I couldn't stop it, even though I knew it was coming. And I asked the guy, how long have you been training? And he said, oh, like 4 months. So I had to start training. And that's when I started in jiu-jitsu in 1997.
Okay, so it's been 21 years.
Been a long time.
And you're still a brown belt.
Yeah. I was probably the world's longest white belt that actually kept with it. I was a white belt for 10 years.
Damn.
From 1997 until 2007.
And now that's because you're in the Army and you're just traveling around all the time.
Yeah. I actually moved to Germany in 1999. And there was very little jiu-jitsu. I couldn't find any, actually, in Germany. So I hooked up with a fight team probably in about 2002 in Stuttgart, Germany.
Okay.
It was a Team Duke fight team at the time. How you doing, Yasin? But... and I just trained in the ground. I trained groundwork with them and trained a little bit of stand up. I don't like getting hit, so I don't do too much stand up.
That's
and
cool.
And I fought a couple times and then got my blue belt in 07 at a Gracie Baja seminar. So I'm actually a Gracie Baja blue belt.
Damn. Now, this seminar, it was with your coach or with a different coach? Or
I didn't have a jiu-jitsu coach. I didn't even have a jiu-jitsu school. It was in a small town in the Alps called Garmisch-Partenkirchen.
Okay.
If you can pronounce it right.
Why did they give you your blue belt? They were just like, they knew you?
I knew the guys from just training around a little bit. And Eddie Bravo's book, Mastering the Rubber Guard, just came out. I'm not a rubber guard guy. I can't hardly touch my toes, but his half guard stuff was, I fell in love with it at the time. And I'd been doing no gi because with the fight team MMA and no gi for a couple of years. So I had no gi experience for the longest time. And I go there and they drill, you know, we learn some stuff and then we roll with everybody. And I was just sweeping everybody with the old school sweep and, you know, from Eddie Bravo's book. And at the end, the instructor was a Gracie Baja black belt. And he asked how long I've been training and he asked my story and I told him. And the next day they had a promotion ceremony and he gave me a blue belt.
That's cool.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing.
I often do that when I meet someone who's been in a similar situation as you, like where they're just one of these like Ronin type dudes who just for whatever reason he doesn't have someone to grade him. And I know you probably weren't going to quit after 10 years as a white belt, but you gotta, I'm surely like getting that blue belt really inspired you and motivated you and helped you.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I think you know, I've never felt ready for any promotion I've gotten in jiu-jitsu, and it always drives me to, you know, now I need to learn more. Now I need to get my understanding a little bit better each time.
So the thing that I noticed about you, Gerald, okay, so you've been training even longer than I have. For you, it's 21 years. For me, it's 18. I just checked today. It's been officially 18. So you say, wow, but you've been literally training longer than me, dude. And it shows when we're on the mat, every single position I do or I'm working with, you have options. You have like a bunch of technical options. You have a very deep and wide range of technical options. And I guess what I wanted to ask you is, how do you maintain, you know, I love jiu-jitsu and it's something I'm going to probably be doing for the rest of my life. Am I like as mad passionate about it as you? No. Right? Because it's kind of like, again, I've used this example over and over again, but it's like, you know, when you're dating someone, the first 6 months are like, God damn, it's like, and then, you know, as you get to know them and maybe eventually marry them, you can love them on a deep level, but it's, the relationship is different.
Almost, right? Definitely, yeah.
It's different. Now, the thing I noticed with you is, It's 21 years in, and man, you are the most passionate guy about jiu-jitsu I've ever met. It blows my mind. Like, where does that come from? Do you think the core of that? Because I'm just very interested.
I would, it's hard for me to say. I think, you know, people say those, you know, the things like jiu-jitsu saved my life and, you know, all that stuff. I don't think it's that, but I think, number one, it's just the art and learning more and getting deeper understanding of the art, you know? Mm-hmm. But also jiu-jitsu, when I didn't have anything else in the world, and there were a couple of times where I really didn't have anything else in the world, but the mats were always there. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Someone was always there to talk to. Even if it was there asking a question about jiu-jitsu or we're just talking about jiu-jitsu, there's always somebody there.
Uh-huh.
And maybe the fact that my mindset really has changed in over the 20 years, so it's never been the same for me.
Mm-hmm.
When I first started, I just wanted to be the toughest guy I knew, and I wanted to beat people up, and I wanted to, you know, do that stuff. Then I got to Tucson, and I learned that there's levels to this jiu-jitsu stuff.
There's always a tougher guy, right?
And there's levels, yeah. And then I wanted to, you know, be the best competitor I could be. And then couple injuries, you know, and I'm not competing as much as I would have thought I would have done by this time. But then my wife started jiu-jitsu, so, you know, I became I'm trying to show her and try to make her the best she can be.
Mm-hmm.
And now that I'm instructing more and more, I'm trying to get my understanding of jiu-jitsu better and be the best jiu-jitsu instructor I can
be.
So I think the roles changed over time. And it's always been there for me when a lot of things weren't.
Yeah. I love that word. I've said it many times. The mat has always been there, dude. Like, there's a lot of peaks and valleys in any human life. Jiu-jitsu is, I know in my life and from the sounds of it, yours, it's that one constant, dude, you know. That's awesome. Now, you spoke about your wife. I'm going to give a shout out to Natalie. She's a lovely lady. One of the things I love is how you guys are both so passionate, and it seems that you keep each other motivated, and it's never just Gerald or Natalie. It's Gerald and Natalie.
Yeah.
And you guys, that's cool, dude. I really respect that a lot. I really do. But, you know, this show, it's not just purely about the mechanics of jiu-jitsu. It's not just about the jiu-jitsu lifestyle. I want to get to know the people I have on, and I want to get to know you a little better in particular. So you're on wife number four now.
Yeah, wife number four. I've been married it'll be going on 21 years in June divided by four.
Okay. So I've got so much to ask you about this. The first thing that springs to mind is Roger's father, a friend of mine, Mauricio Gomez, who is also one of the coolest guys I know. And I think he's been married 5 times, if I'm not mistaken. So I said to him one day, I was like, Mauricio, what have you learned having been married 5 times? What's the lesson in this? So, you know, he paused, he looked off into the distance, and he went, you know, Nick, I've realized I am not the marrying kind. It's still to this day one of the things that makes me laugh more than anything is recalling that. But tell me what, okay, so look, I think you should, clearly you and Natalie should be married because you guys have got something special. I see it. You guys have a fantastic relationship. But after, let's say, number three, what made you want to go for number four?
I think it's the fact, well, so number three,
let's start with number one.
I should start at number one because it kind of really tells a story. So, it wasn't my high school sweetheart, but she was my right after high school sweetheart.
Okay.
You know, I knew she was the one. So, right when I joined the Army, I went to training and all that, and then I went up to Fort Lewis in Washington State. That was my first duty station. And then I brought her up. We got married immediately. I think I was 20.
Mm-hmm.
And then we moved to Germany together and maybe grew apart, you know, as I was growing up and she was growing up, and it just wasn't working,
mm-hmm.
you know. So we split up. And then I met my wife number two in Sarajevo, Bosnia-Herzegovina, in a bar, being the ugly American, not knowing that people in Europe speak English too. So she came walking past me, and she was beautiful. And she said, excuse me. And as she walked by, I said, dang, you can pass me anytime you want to. And she turned around and said, you sure about that? And I was like, oh, well, I made an ass out of myself. we met in Bosnia, and we fell in love, and life was good. And then we went to, she came to Germany with me when we got, and we got married. And she changed a lot. She's one of those old school type of people that once you get married, it's you and that person, and you should never even want to go out with friends and have a beer. You shouldn't want to be away from that person.
Okay.
And I even, it started an argument when I told her, listen, if I'm your only source of conversation, entertainment, everything other than yourself, then it's not a healthy relationship.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But she didn't see it the same way. So we started growing apart, and then, yeah, I earned that divorce, though, I will say. She became a monster, but she was a monster that I really helped a lot to create.
Damn.
Because I was a young guy, 25, 26, and I'm traveling, every other week. I'm going to Moscow for 5 days, or I'm going to Tel Aviv for 3 days, or Sofia, Bulgaria. And then I come home, and my wife is being a jerk, because I was being a jerk, not knowing, not mm-hmm. overtly, not that I could see, but I was just like, why is she always being an asshole when I come
mm-hmm,
home?
Mm-hmm.
So it made me not want to come home. And I remember one time we were arguing about something, and I told her, I said, babe, if you don't want me, somebody else will. And in a fit of rage, she said, well, go get with whoever you want to get with.
Damn.
That was a bad idea.
She didn't have to twist your arm behind your back.
Yeah, no, that was a bad idea. So that really... it was a maturity thing too, I think, with me.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm not that same person that is so quick to argue, quick to fight, and is spiteful.
Mm-hmm.
But so we broke up, and then I met number three. This is crazy, right? How it's in succession.
No, it's interesting.
And we met, and I was at a pretty low point when we met, because we had just I had broken up with my ex-wife, and even though I was a staff sergeant in the Army, so I was making about $4,500 a month or so.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was living off of about $300 a month, and I was driving a 1993 Ford Fiesta, and this was in 2007.
Yeah.
Because my ex-wife had been, she'd been some crazy stuff, and all my money was tied up with her.
Mm-hmm.
And when I met my wife number three, she was like, I'm not with your bank account, I'm with you. And that really stuck with me. She was a German woman.
Mm-hmm.
So I end up getting out of the active duty Army, joining the reserve, and coming back to California. And me and my fiance girlfriend at the time, we kept she came and visited me. I went out there and visited her. And then I came back into the Army as a recruiter. And then I brought her over to California, and we got married. And this was the second biggest mistake of my life, I think. Not the marriage part, but as an Army recruiter, your life is really, really, really busy. And I let my work become my life rather than my life, working to live. I was living to work.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't even realize that my wife was slowly but surely, with one foot out the door. And one day in 2007, we were sitting on the couch after work, and she said, I want to go home. And she left. And I thought to myself, I actually thought I did it right that time, because I wasn't out there doing all the stuff that I was doing
mm-hmm.
with wife,
mm-hmm.
With wife number two. And it broke me. It broke me. I was down. I was at my low. That was literally my lowest point in life.
Damn. Your lowest point in life.
It was bad. It was bad. And because of a couple reasons. So she went back to Germany, and I wanted to go see her. Well, because of some legal issues with wife number one, we're still cool. I'm not gonna say nothing, but because of those legal issues, it was difficult at the time for me to get a passport, so I couldn't even get over there to try to win my ex-wife back.
Damn,
it was crazy.
That must have been frustrating as hell.
It was, and so I'd be calling every day and asking if she wants to come home and this stuff, and then everything worked out to where I took care of that legal stuff, and I got my passport, and I flew over there. And I was going to stay over there for like a week. And we were visiting, and I thought everything was cool, but like she never wanted to go out anywhere with me. And she didn't even take off work right? Oh, so I knew something was going on.
Yeah.
But desperate me, I'm thinking, hey, I can fix this, you know, and that. And at the time, one of my really, really good friends, Adam, and his ex-wife now, Rebecca, were living with me in my apartment, splitting rent. Mm-hmm. And he actually took care of me at the time. He fronted me some of the rent money for the next month. And I sprung for a 4-day trip to Paris with my wife to try to make things work. Mm-hmm. Worst decision of my life. I'll never go to Paris again. It was bad. But nothing worked. The whole time we were there, she wouldn't even talk to me about our relationship. I just don't want to talk about it now. I can't talk about it now.
Yeah.
The whole time I was there.
Yeah.
So I came back and I was like, I'm done. And you know, I cut everything off with her. I got rid of everything of hers that was at the house. It was, you know, in a boxes in the corner. And that was, at that point, that was where I was lost. I was a lost person. I didn't know what I was going to do. I didn't, you know, I tell people all the time, I wasn't suicidal, never been suicidal because, mm-hmm. you know, breakfast tastes good and food tastes good. I'm not going anywhere mm-hmm. by choice, you know? But I didn't care if I lived or died. I was at that point in life. Mm-hmm. And the only thing I had at that time was, I trained with a fight team in Vallejo, California, you know, the Asylum fight team, and those guys.
So Matt was always there.
Yep, Matt was always there. Mm-hmm. And I still every time I go there, I back to California, I go with them and go over there and teach a class and all that.
That's great.
Yeah, Asylum fight team. then I was literally lost. Uh-huh. And then it sounds crazy, but I was messing around on Plenty of Fish and I saw a picture of this woman that was pretty and I just emailed her and it said, hey, I'm just getting back in the dating scene after splitting up and just wanted to talk, you know? And she emailed me back. And then 2 days later, we talked on the phone. And a day after that, we actually met. And then from day five to today, we've been living together.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah.
That's cool that it worked out for you. Yeah. I guess I have so many interesting questions and comments on this. The first is, what never ceases to amaze me is, you know, like, people think that women take breakups bad, but it's been my personal experience, and also I've noticed the experience of male friends in my life, that it's usually the guy who takes things worse. You know, I remember, okay, like, you spoke about the lowest point in your life.
Yeah.
Mine as well was related to a relationship, and it was, I was also overseas, and, you know, I was fucking low, dude. And I remember I met this guy. I was teaching a jiu-jitsu seminar, I think it was in San Diego. This was close to 8 years ago. Around the time I was going through this horrible thing. And this dude, I remember he was like a 220-pound, ripped, hardcore Navy SEAL dude who, I think, he'd done a tour of Afghanistan, like, legit man. Mm-hmm. You know, like, by any account, he was a legit man. And this guy was telling me, I was talking to him a little bit about what I've been through, and he said, bro, I have never been so broken as I was by this 110-pound girl I was dating. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
She broke me worse than any dude has ever broken me in a physical confrontation or anything like that. And that blew my mind. And you realize just how powerful... and how women have it over us, right?
It
blows my mind.
I think also, though, it's also that, you know, men are fixers. You know, we have a problem, we fix it. And when it's something that we want so bad and nothing we can do in our power, there's literally nothing in our control to do it, I think that breaks us more than, or at least as much as a relationship loss.
You said it. I mean, something my fiance says to me all the time, she says, like, I'm not a computer, you can't work me out. And I'm like, but, you know, it's what men do. Is, like, when you said fixer, that stuck with me. It's for me, it's like, I want to figure out the logical rationale of the situation. Like, if she acts like X, then I do Y, right? And then sometimes if she acts like X, I do Y and I get result C. Mm-hmm. But sometimes she acts like X, I do Y and I get result D. And then I'll bring it up to her and I'll be like, but last time I did that, you were fine with it. And she was like, I'm not a computer. It doesn't work like that. And God fucking damn it, that's frustrating, bro. Because that's how my mind works. It works with logic. And I'm sure that's how yours works as well.
Yeah, right? I got told, you know, when I was in by a therapist one time that I'm a very, I seem very analytical and less emotional, more analytical when it comes to relationship stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it really is because of wife number three. You know, I really started making choices based on what I think and not what I feel. So like with every choice in life, I don't care what it is, even marrying my wife. And I told her that what I do is I take the emotion out of it and use common sense, and I let the answer, you know, work itself out.
Wow.
Which is it's a great way to do stuff a lot of times, but sometimes it might seem cold.
Okay, fair enough. Now, before we close this topic, I guess for the younger jiu-jitsu dude out there who is thinking of getting married for the first time, I don't want to put him off. I really don't want to do that. But what I would like from you is to hear the one piece of advice you would give to someone that you learned on those first three marriages that you've been able to use to make this fourth one work properly.
The one piece of advice, man. I made so many mistakes. There's a lot of advice. I would say don't think marriage is going to change anything. If you have this idea that marriage is going to make your good relationship better, it's not. You're going to make it better. And if you have this idea that a lot of people do, that getting married will make a bad relationship good, it doesn't. It just legally requires that person to be there, you know? So don't have an expectation that marriage is going to do anything other than solidify your relationship, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. I think that would be my
advice. That sounds like pretty solid advice. Yeah, thank you. I'm going to take that myself. So Gerald, the thing I find, one of the things I find most interesting about you, there's many, but one of them is that you are a retired military man. Mm-hmm. So how old are you, Gerald?
I'm 41.
41, okay. And you're retired, which means you did how many years?
I did 20 years, 8 months, 23 days.
Okay, wow. I remember I was here about a year and a half ago, and you weren't quite done, but you were literally, I was like, how much longer to go? And you were like 6 weeks, 3 days, 12 hours, and 42 minutes or something like that. You know, the thing I find most interesting, one of the things I find fascinating about living in the United States is just how entwined the military is with everyday life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we live here in Tucson, not far from an army base, and there's a lot of military personnel in this town. And like, you'll go into pretty much any store and there'll be a sticker saying we give military discounts, mm-hmm. or there's veterans discounts, or like, and you know, everyone knows how much the U.S. spends on its defense, how much of its budget. Yeah, it's just, I never quite understood what a huge part of American life it is. And you took me onto the base the other day, and it just blew my mind. You said something. We were walking around, and we went into the, is it called the PX?
Yeah, the Air Force calls it the BX, but I don't listen to that. It's the PX.
The PX, okay. So it's like a grocery store for military people. And you said to me, you know, like, and the people, you couldn't really tell they were in the military because they were wearing civilian clothes, but you were like, whenever I walk around here, I just think to myself, some of these people have killed people. And that blew my mind. I wanted to know a bit more about, you know, why you went into the army, why you stayed so long, maybe some crazy stories of things that happened to you during that time.
Okay. The truest story I can tell. I joined the army because making mochas and lattes got boring. no lie. I was working in a grocery store in the cafe section in Raley's in Folsom, California. And I did not want to be a 30-year grocery store employee. It just seemed boring to me. So I thought I wanted to be a police officer, but I wasn't old enough to go to the academy. So I said, you know what, I'll do a couple years in the military, and then I'll get out and be Sacramento PD or Sacramento County Sheriff or something like that. Mm-hmm. So I joined the Army as a military policeman, and never looked back, really. Was up in Washington first, and then I got a chance to move over to Europe, and I lived in Germany for 8 years, and I got a great job as security. I did protective service for dignitaries and generals in Europe and in 35 countries, in Europe and Africa, and it was just so fun.
Mm-hmm.
It was so fun. The reason I stayed so long is because I got paid way too much money at the time to do what I was doing. And then by the time that fun part stopped, I already had over 10 years then. So I was, you know, less than a decade from getting a check for the rest of my life. So mm-hmm. I said, why not? You know, why not stay?
Mm-hmm. And the thing that always blows my mind will be, you showed me the PX and like how you got, I mean, the food in there is incredibly cheap and you can go shop there for the rest of your life. And then you get healthcare and a whole bunch of cool things. And you always say to me whenever I'm like blown away by whatever advantage that I discover through you, membership has its privileges.
Membership really does have its privileges.
Yeah, that's cool. I really like that. I kind of was thinking the other day after I've been spending some time with you, like maybe if I could do it all again, maybe I've always been fascinated by the military. Like it's not like I don't condone war, and I think war is like the most horrific thing that humanity's ever produced, but I have such a respect for soldiers, man. And I think that you know, people who adopt that mindset that just because the military industrial complex is doing a whole bunch of fucked up shit that makes everyone who enlists bad, I think that's fucking stupid and short-sighted. And some of the best people I've met have been military personnel. It instills a kind of a sense of responsibility and a sense of discipline. And I think that there's a lot of kids today, fuck, I sound like my dad, who probably could do with like a year or two in the military.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think the biggest thing the military, you know, people think that it's that like a military training changes you mentally and it does all that. I don't really think I come off as a military person or carry myself as a military person, even though I, you know, this is what I did for such a long time.
Just for the record, Gerald currently has purple toenails, just to put it into perspective.
True story, right? But I think the biggest thing that with military people is if they have a task, they're going to complete the task. You know,
that's awesome.
It doesn't, whatever it is, whatever it takes, as long as it's legal, moral, and ethical, that's our job to get stuff done. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the really, one of the biggest things that the Army gave me is that we got to get this done. Let's go do it. You know, just get it knocked out.
Yeah. If I'm a white belt for 10 years, my task is to get a black belt. Doesn't matter how long
one
it
one day
takes.
I'll be there. That's
cool. So Gerald, you're someone, who, as I said, you've got this amazing passion for jiu-jitsu. Unparalleled. I have never met anyone who has that level of passion. You are not just a player of jiu-jitsu. You're a student of the art and the history of the art and the progression of the art. And you've probably watched more jiu-jitsu videos than anyone else I've ever met. And you follow this sport so closely. You know all the scores. Ollie Geddes and you probably have... You're probably close when it comes to jiu-jitsu knowledge. So I wanted to ask you, where do you see jiu-jitsu progressing? Like, let's say we could take a time machine 10 years into the future. What do you think jiu-jitsu is going to look like? What do you think the major difference will be between the jiu-jitsu of then and today?
You know, I don't know. The game has changed so much from, you know, the 90s and the 2000s. And now everybody's doing these, you know, advanced fancy guards and, you know, a lot of this inversion stuff. It'd be interesting to see if there's more positions people can do, more things. I think the rules really are going to dictate where jiu-jitsu goes.
Mm-hmm. You said something to me, if I may interrupt you, Joel. You said that you think a reversal... or an escape from the bottom that takes you to the top and puts him on his back should score points.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. I think that to make the officiating easier and to make it easier to watch and to make more sense, if you deliberately go from a bottom position to a top position and you use whatever technique you can to get to that top position, mm-hmm. And your opponent's not giving it to you, of course, I think it should be points.
Mm, that's interesting. I've often thought how, you know, how... 30 years ago, half guard, like back in Brazil, half guard was considered a hugely inferior position. Yep. And now dudes use it to attack and bullhole games around there. I often think, it's just as a thought experiment, will there come a point, you know, Eduardo Telles uses the turtle mm-hmm. as his attacking platform. Will there come a point where someone is so good at being at the bottom of side mount that they will literally pull side mount to use that to sweep or attack?
I think it has to happen. I mean, as many people are doing jiu-jitsu, there's going to be someone that's going to try to find their niche, you know, find their little special, you know, position. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's already people that try to break my arm off from bottom side control. And you know, when you're with that, I don't know what you call it, when you're around the, getting close to their head and they wrench up really hard to reverse you, mm-hmm, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But I think some people will figure out a way to, you know, make like a reverse crucifix mm-hmm. from the bottom or something like that.
It blew my mind yesterday. I was sparring with that monster. There's this, he's Los Angeles Open absolute and weight champion in the black belt. His name's Abraham, really cool Brazilian dude at Undisputed. And we were doing sparring from the back and I got on his back and I started to fish for the collar grip and he gave it to me really easily. And I was just like, come on, dude, I'm, you're not that much better than me. And then as I got that grip, he attacked me with the submission, like a wrist lock on the grip of the lapel. And I was just like, holy shit. Like, I mean, 5 years ago, that 6 years ago, 7 years ago, that would have been like, it would have blown my mind. But now it's just like, yeah, that's to be expected. There's attacks from everywhere now.
Yeah, everywhere. Yeah. It's a rare thing that I get confused and don't know what the person is doing when I'm rolling with them. Mm-hmm. With Abraham, that happens quite a few times. So I have to stop and say, wait, what did you just do to me right there?
Yeah. Gerald Mament, what an absolute pleasure it's been to have you on the show. It's definitely, you're going to be a regular guest, I'm sure, especially we live just down the road from each other now. And I just want to thank you for taking the time to come be on the show. Is there anyone you want to give a shout out to, or if people want to find out more about, I suppose you don't really have a gym or anything like that, but if people want to get in touch with you, or maybe take a private lesson, or is there anything you want the listeners to know?
If you want to get in touch with me, you can find me on Facebook, Gerald Garland. There's a couple of me on there. Only one of them I use now. It's a long story. Look for the one in the orange shirt.
Only one of them is married 4 times.
There you go. The only person I want to give a shout out to is my wife, Natalie. Love you, babe.
Nice. Okay, guys. Thanks for listening. I told you he was a cool guy. He's the kind of person who always brings a smile to my face. I said to him recently that he was away. He's at every class, every single class without fail. I've never seen him miss one. But recently he was away. And when he got back, I said to him, the mat is just not the same without you. You know, it just doesn't have the same vibe and the same spirit when he's not there. And, you know, there's an expression I'm really fond of, which is live the kind of life so that when you die, even the undertaker will be sad. And I really believe that's true about people like Gerald. You know, if he were to die, everyone who knows him would miss him and mourn him and have good things to say about him. And it's a testament to the kind of person he is. So thanks again for coming on the show, Gerald. And thank you guys for listening. Keep an eye out and an ear open for my new online academy, which is coming soon. It's called, we've settled on a name called the Master Academy. And it's something that started about 2 years ago. The idea formed in my mind. It's gone through various name changes and revisions and things like that. But it's finally become something that I'm happy with. And we're going to be releasing it to the public soon. And I think it's going to be something pretty special. So keep an eye out for that. I'll give you guys more details in the coming weeks. Okay, guys, until next week, peace out.